I've always had a good deal of sympathy for Franz Kafka's contention that a book must be the axe for the frozen sea within us.
If you're a writer and you don't feel that it's a calling,
the challenge, as always, is to create something that is truly original, defying all expectations and breaking bold new ground.
It goes without saying, if you want to be a smart literary author, you have to read smart literary books.
Greetings and felicitations and thank you, one and all, for dropping in for another episode of my podcast, Standing at an Angle to the Universe, the program where we microdose the matrix and treat reality like the simulation it almost certainly is. I'm Cliff Burns, your contrarian in residence, propped in front of the microphone yet again, eager to cause offense in the name of free speech, critical thinking, and intelligent discourse. Regular listeners, if there is such a thing, will have noticed by now that I am more than just a tad obsessed with rescuing certain authors or books from obscurity. Hell, I even devote an entire segment of the show, Fritz Leiber's Pencil Case, to novels, stories, or poetry that, in my opinion, deserve wider exposure. So it should come as no surprise that this episode, titled In Praise of Lost Books, delves even deeper into the subject with my usual, very personal take on things front and center. Before I really get into it, I want to acknowledge some folks who have made it part of their mission to identify and advocate on behalf of lost books, in some cases reprinting them and making them available to contemporary readers. Let's start with the New York Review of Books imprint, which has done a tremendous job of identifying great books that have gone out of print or failed to catch on with readers of their day. Their roster of titles include many fine translations and always come with an informative introduction by some of today's leading literary lights who are anxious to share their favorite obscurities with the rest of us. And kudos as well to Brad Bigelow's Neglected Books page, which he has studiously curated since 2006. You can find it online, neglectedbooks.com, and believe me, you'll be very impressed with what Brad's accomplished. Let me also plug the efforts of the late Christopher Fowler, who wrote a column for the Independent newspaper, drawing attention to titles deserving of rediscovery. A number of these columns were incorporated into a book, Invisible Ink, How 100 Great Authors Disappeared, which you can order through your favorite indie bookstore. Okay. I guess the first question we should address is why a perfectly good book, one that is well-composed, structurally and aesthetically sound, original and intelligent, can fail to connect with readers to the extent that said book goes out of print and over the years becomes harder and harder to find. In her introduction to Illuminations, a collection of essays by German literary and cultural critic Walter Benjamin, Hannah Arendt writes, "Posthumous fame is too odd a thing to be blamed upon the blindness of the world or the corruption of a literary milieu. Nor can it be said that it is the bitter reward of those who were ahead of their time, as though history were a racetrack on which some contenders run so swiftly that they simply disappear from the spectator's range of vision. Posthumous fame seems, then, to be the lot of the unclassifiable ones, that is, those whose work neither fits the existing order nor introduces a new genre that lends itself to future classification. Innumerable attempts to write a la Kafka, all of them dismal failures, have only served to emphasize Kafka's uniqueness, that absolute originality which can be traced to no predecessor and suffers no followers. This is what society can least come to terms with, and upon which it will always be very reluctant to bestow its seal of approval." End quote. I think there's something to what she's saying. Neglected or obscure books are quite often one-offs inimitable and unprecedented, and therefore not likely to appeal to a reading public used to predictable, formulaic efforts that conform to traditional narrative approaches. Franz Kafka is a perfect example. How many readers from his era up to ours would find his books and fragments palatable, user-friendly? During his lifetime, he sold less than 200 copies of his books. Think about that. And was unknown outside a small circle of writers and devotees who recognized his genius and, following his death, did their best to keep his work alive. Max Brod, his literary executor, famously ignored Kafka's request to burn most of his work, and it's because of him that Kafka achieved the acclaim and respect he rightfully deserves, while still remaining better known than read, only his short story Metamorphosis cracking into the mainstream. Most of us have an inkling of what the term Kafkaesque denotes, but how many could quote a single line from his body of work? Anyone? Speaking personally, the only way I can, I have to say that I have a profound fear of what happens to my books once the curtain is rung down and I'm handed a harp and an infinite roll of sheet music and told to take a seat along with everybody else. One of the great benefits of being an independent writer and publisher is that for as long as I draw breath, my work, all that is fit for publishing, will remain in print. What happens afterward? Well, that's up to my heirs and descendants and the vicissitudes of posterity. And I suppose it also depends on a few loyal readers and friends who see merit in my writing and are willing to do their small part to keep my books from fading away like images on old celluloid film. I think it would be fascinating to convene a panel of writers and ask them if they dread slipping into obscurity, ending up consigned to the literary trash heap. The hacks would dismiss the notion out of hand, since they're only in it for the money anyway. What do they care if their titles go out of print? They've already had their payday and suspected all along their work would have a limited shelf life and are all right with that. But what about the others? The authors who have artistic aspirations and some appreciation for literature's long, distinguished pedigree. Will they be fortunate enough to have dedicated readers willing to expend the time and energy to preserve their work? Because good books need their champions, people who consciously seek out writers who have slipped beneath the radar. I'm one of those people. I'll learn about a certain title almost by accident, name-dropped by a colleague or referenced in an article by someone whose opinion I've learned to trust. And I can't resist doing a deep dive into the author in question, finding out something of their life, trying to discern what it is that distinguishes their work from lesser lights. And I'll be brutally honest. Besides the sheer joy of uncovering a hidden gem, I also believe that by reading and recommending lost writers, I'm hoping for some kind of karmic boomerang effect, that someday someone will do the same for my books. Come across one of my titles in a future equivalent of a thrift or antique shop, or find an intriguing snippet quoted in an arts publication, taking note of my name, firing up their favorite search engine, and away they go. Because as long as books are published in any format, there will be titles lost in the mix, tomes sufficiently brilliant and original to deserve preserving for future generations. I think there are something like 4 million books published every year. Most are mediocre to appalling, but there will be a select few which exhibit an artfulness and sublimity that renders them ageless, works that help us better understand the human spirit and our place within the ever-spreading universe. Nicholson Baker, bibliophile extraordinaire, once said, "The function of a great library is to store obscure books." But nowadays, libraries are not merely or primarily repositories for thousands of books on every subject. They are also social gathering spots and family-friendly facilities incorporating play areas and maker spaces. Increasingly, books, the greatest source of knowledge and information in the history of our species, are less and less important and relevant in a world that puts far more value in the tactile and image-driven than volumes gathering dust on a diminishing number of shelves. Maybe it's a logical byproduct of a society that favors ephemera over epiphany, popular trends and hashtags over troubling knowledge and difficult, hard-won insights. I actually did a presentation that dealt with the changing face of libraries as part of my local library region's 50th anniversary back in September 2022. I've been a library patron for more than half a century, and during my chat, I spoke of the importance of libraries at this point in human history, how valuable, trustworthy, authoritative information will become, especially to those of us wishing to make educated, ethical decisions regarding game-changing scientific advances in AI, nanotechnology, and genetics. I'll probably end up appending that presentation to this series as a bonus episode or whatever, we'll see. In the end, I believe it will only be through the diligence and persistence of readers that a good, worthy book is prevented from falling prey to time's grim, relentless handiwork. Posterity is not assured, and regardless of the level of craftsmanship and talent involved, books can be lost. Lost forever, like the fabled missing footage from Orson Welles' The Magnificent Ambersons and all the burnt reels of Stroheim's legendary production of Greed. Literary scholarship is presently in the hands of postmodernists and the alphabet people, who concern themselves with the narrowest possible reading and interpretation. They, of course, favor books that support and promulgate their point of view, confirming everything they already know. The skill that went into the writing of a book, the undeniable talent of its author, none of that is as important as how the book makes them feel. If it challenges their precious assumptions and beliefs, it must be discarded, and beyond that, demonized, to the point where people are actively discouraged from seeking it out. What's the difference between canceling or erasing a book from existence and physically putting a match to it? I'm not sure. And any talk of universality is ridiculed. Authors can no longer write for the masses, but for niche groups catering to victim narratives, penning heartfelt autobiographical tales of trauma, survival, and, it goes without saying, personal heroism. There seem to be a lot of heroes around these days, don't you think? We all have a story to tell, right? And any attempt to impose quality control and professional standards is elitism, the oppressiveness of a dominant culture seeking to control or limit those who have been disenfranchised through no fault of their own. In this context, the words of writers from bygone days reflect only the intolerance and hatefulness of those times. No talk of artistic merit or historical significance allowed. It's all about imposing a retroactive morality, a cultural Calvinism that discourages wide reading and mocks the very notion of classical literature. Madame Bovary and Don Quixote have nothing to teach us and don't address the problems of the world circa 2023. Crime and Punishment needs to be updated to modern sensibilities, Raskolnikov rehabilitated, his murderous proclivities downgraded to long, angst-laden passages describing his abusive childhood. It seems that the problem with great books of the past, both classics and neglected, is that too many were written by dead, white, heterosexual males, which makes them suspect in an era of sensitivity editors and intimacy coordinators on call 24/7, looking for anything that might offend somebody or trigger some vulnerable little twerp in Poughkeepsie who breaks into a sweat anytime someone so much as raises their voice. The lost classics of today will be the titles that dare to defy those strictures and self-regarding mindsets, telling stories with morally sketchy protagonists and unsettling narratives that refuse to offer comforting solutions or happy, reassuring endings. Posterity won't be as kind to those authors who chose to pay lip service to political correctness, willingly neutering themselves for the sake of fitting in, checking all the right boxes. They happily towed the line, dewy-eyed conformists with an eagerness to please. Their names will be forgotten, their willingness to collaborate with our society's moral arbiters not sitting well with the gods of literature. A special ring in hell awaits them, and I, for one, will be selling marshmallows and ringside seats to anyone who, like me, will take great pleasure in watching them burn, a bonfire of dull vanities, just dessert for the craven and false. Time for another thrilling installment of Trolling the Zeitgeist, an excuse to rant about life in the idiocracy, the bad, the worse, and the truly ugly on the socio-cultural scene. You know, every so often I pause in front of the book racks in my local Walmart or wherever, pick up a volume at random, open it to a page, any page, and read. Usually it doesn't take more than two or three paragraphs before the tunelessness and ineptitude begin to manifest themselves. Some of the authors in question are practically brand names. They're so popular. You'd recognize them if they said who they were. Their books is ubiquitous as blowflies on a three-day-old corpse. People buy their titles by the pound. We're talking about millions and millions of copies, and I can't for the life of me figure out why. What is apparent is that the majority of these books have about a grade 9 reading level, and if they are, in fact, vetted and edited, the person in charge must have recently suffered a serious head injury. I often find typos, egregious misspellings, and that's just from the most cursory browsing. Bestseller? You must be joking, mate. But it's no joke. Increasingly, readers are seeking out books that offer comfort and easy reading, derivative, unchallenging, and formulaic. Nothing that's going to tax their minds. I've heard numerous excellent literary authors, including the great Will Self, bemoaning the lack of smart readers out there, people who enjoy superbly crafted, brain-stretching fiction. So if someone was to ask me, "Hey, Cliff, what's the point of seeking out these strange, obscure books you keep harping about?" my first response would be, because it's got to be miles better than the shit on display at your local Borders or Barnes & Noble, whole magnitudes more intelligent and gripping than Amazon's current crop of top sellers. The problem, simply put, is that there are too bloody many bad books being published these days. There's a hilarious South Park episode about James Cameron having to descend into the depths of the ocean to find how low the bar has sunk in terms of acceptable behavior or community norms and standards. And that's what happens when every airhead in the world thinks they're an author with an absolutely scintillating story to tell. And never mind that it's little more than a narcissistic exploration of their own rectums. Sorry, I meant heartfelt memoir. Or yet another tawdry example of the fan fiction exploding all over the place, like an invasive species swarming into and despoiling a formerly pristine wilderness area. The really, really horrible news is that the situation is going to get even worse in the near future, as artificial intelligence and advanced robotics combine to create a largely automated world where human workers are superfluous. Even the traditionally human-oriented service sector will be affected. Sustained by universal basic income, essential if some semblance of capitalism is to survive, this vast army of underemployed will be seeking new identities and pastimes to give them busy work, a sense of self-identity and purpose for being, which means many will become, God help us, artists. A flood of amateur filmmakers, sculptors, scribblers, and wannabe Warhols flooding our public spaces, real and virtual, demanding that their work be treated with the respect it deserves, anxious to tell anyone who'll listen why they're so special and, well, amazing. We are talking about a truly dark age for our species. This absolute tsunami of horrible art will render any notions of professionalism or competence irrelevant. Such attitudes not welcome in a world where you can't throw a rock without hitting someone working on a screenplay or book of poetry about a beloved childhood pet. 4 million books a year published already. What will it be like a decade from now? The mind boggles. The sad, awful, tragic part is with all that crap being excreted, it will be even more difficult to identify the genuinely gifted, those who courageously seek to expand the boundaries of their medium, enriching and enlivening our cultural sphere. And again I ask, how many great authors will be lost in the mix, and who will sift through all that debris and detritus in 20 or 50 years, unearthing the talented artists who defined our era while subverting all the norms, boldly crafting original, innovative work. Maybe some futuristic AI will come up with an infallible algorithm for detecting genius. I guess we should take what we can get. Does it matter if I'm granted posterity by a human agent or a HAL 9000 computer? Well, not really. By then I'll be long gone, my copyrights expired, scheming great grand heirs trying to monetize my work for as long and as much as they can. But who's to say there will still be readers in that era? Isn't it far more likely that those wishing a source of entertainment will simply plug into an interactive environment and consort with all manner of celebrities or historical figures? Wouldn't even the greatest books pale in comparison? Why read Tolstoy when you can speak to him in person, or at least a computer simulation of the actual person? Every last byte of data, every biographical footnote converted to code, enabling the creation of a three-dimensional, living and breathing replica, accurate right down to his accent and all-consuming conscience. One thing I know for damn sure, posterity, whether bestowed by humans or non-humans, will have nothing to do with the vast majority of popular authors today. And that's obvious because how many of the popular, audience-pleasing bestsellers from the 20th century are currently scheduled for release by the New York Review of Books imprint or some of the excellent small presses that have taken it upon themselves to reprint lost literary gems? Answer? Pretty damn few. Authors with names like Mary Ward, E. Phillips Oppenheim, Harold Bell Wright, and Warwick Deeping sold untold thousands of copies at their peak. Today, they're as forgotten as the guy who used to clean the elephant cage at the Barnum and Bailey Circus. They were hacks who got some fleeting fame and earned a few pieces of silver for writing to the marketplace, one eye always on popular trends or news stories that caught the public eye for the allotted 15 minutes. Personally, I don't begrudge them their short-lived success. I made a determination a long time ago to serve the cause of literature, not the god of mammon. I have no idea if my service will be rewarded. I only know I don't want to be just another sheep in the herd, indistinguishable and undistinguished. Reading past masters, both celebrated and obscure, reminds me that there is a higher calling to the arts, something that eclipses the importance of fame and fortune. Primo Levi wrote, "All we ask of those who create is that they should be neither servile nor false." Good writers not only know this to be true, it is part of what keeps them going, despite all the obstacles and frustrations they face, the disappointments and heartache they endure on a daily basis. Whether posterity singles them out or not, they are part of a glorious tradition, contributing to the cultural history of our species, refuting a mindset that considers books mere products and readers as nothing more than dumb, cud-chewing consumers. Here endeth the rant. I call this segment Fritz Leiber's Pencil Case, and I always look forward to this part of the show because it's where I get to pillage my shelves for books that have slipped through the cracks and haven't earned the close attention and respect they rightfully deserve. Because of my decidedly singular tastes, there are quite a few books of that description in my personal library. As previously acknowledged, I'm something of a literary bloodhound. When I hear about an author who sounds interesting, I make a mental note. If that name crops up again, my interest ratchets up accordingly and I physically add it to a small black book that contains my literary wish list going back 20 or 30 years. By now, you must have some inkling that I have little truck with average, tepid, middle-of-the-road writers who stick to formula like bugs to flypaper, and are more interested in expanding their readership and padding their bank account than they are advancing the cause of literature. And it goes back to that Hannah Arendt quote at the beginning of this episode. My respect and affection for the unclassifiable ones, prose that exhibits uniqueness and originality, the one-offs, so inimitable the authors stand alone and unsullied by either the fickleness of lay readers or the crass stupidity of the marketplace. I don't want to belabor the point since my time is limited and there are a lot of titles I want to cover in the course of this program, so let's get on with it. I'll begin with William Kotzwinkel, actually two titles by Kotzwinkel. The first is Fan Man, a cult novel if there ever was one. Why am I so fascinated by central characters that are weirdo losers existing on the fringes of society? Horst Bedordi, that's his name, the protagonist of Fan Man, lives in absolute squalor in the Lower East Side of New York. The era is the early 1970s, and Horst's world is replete with encounters with various street people and down-and-outers, each episode recounted stream-of-consciousness style, a torrent of impressions and observations that amount to sheer bloody genius. The other Kotzwinkel book I want to touch on is completely different, centered around a stillbirth the author and his wife endured, and how they experienced and processed that loss. Swimmer in a Secret Sea is a short, unforgettable book, unflinching, courageous, and incredibly moving. Switching gears, and there's going to be a lot of that in this segment, the next title I want to plug is Norman Spinrad's Bug Jack Baron, a quintessential hippie-era science fiction tale filled with paranoia, conspiracies, and pointed digs at the rich and powerful. There have been numerous attempts to adapt it for the big screen. At one point, Harlan Ellison was tapped to write the script, but none have made it past the drawing board. No wonder. This one never relents. But its central notion that the wealthy would be willing to sacrifice the poor and powerless in order to indefinitely prolong their greedy existence is one that should resonate today. Fuel Injected Dreams by James Robert Baker is a bittersweet Valentine addressed to the music industry, featuring a very Phil Spector-like character, obsessed and dangerous, and written by an author struggling with his own personal demons and career setbacks. Baker ended up taking his own life, a depressing postscript, but one that does not diminish the undeniable power and appeal of the novel. Ken Grimwood's Replay made something of a splash when it first came out, but its cool concept, living your life over and over again, though overused these days, would still draw many readers, methinks, especially the dark, suspenseful take on the trope Grimwood adopts throughout. Two gritty urban crime novels make the bill, Seth Morgan's Homeboy and Abraham Rodriguez Jr.'s Spider-Town. Both skillfully present a street-level view of the drug trade, the little details lending an authenticity to the novels that make the skin crawl. There isn't a false note in either, and they will leave a mark on you, somewhere between a bruise and a brand. Two more authors I'm going to rudely lump together are Laurie Baker and Jim Kniffel. They have one amazing thing in common. Both have books boasting glowing praise from none other than Thomas Pynchon. The Pinch doesn't dole out blurbs very often, so when he does, I tend to sit up and take notice. Kniffel's stuff is otherworldly and mad, both Slackjaw and The Buzzing confirming that he is indisputably one of a kind, an albino unicorn. In other words, exactly the sort of inspired lunatic I tend to seek out. Laurie Baker's The Glass Ocean is something of a different variety, a haunting historical novel centered around the sea and one particular expedition that casts its shadow over numerous lives, a mysterious, oniric offering. Denton Welch. My God, Denton Welch. I once read that he was William S. Burroughs' favorite author, and so I kept an eye out for him. Literally loved every word I've read by the man. A memoirist, but so much more than that. His observational skills, gift with language, peerless. Much of his work was composed after he suffered a near-fatal injury while riding a bicycle. He survived, but spent the remainder of his life an invalid, racked with constant pain, yet somehow managing to write some of the most beautiful, limpid prose I've encountered. And then there are Grace Krulanovich's The Orange Eats Creeps and David Ohl's Motorman. They don't share a common theme and in many ways are worlds apart, but both are unclassifiable, atypical, and more than moderately brilliant. No attempt to summarize them is possible. I'll merely opine that fans of William Burroughs and maybe Donald Barthelme have a head start. Not recommended for readers who like their books rational and structured. Some mental bench pressing definitely required. Ditto when it comes to the work of Alexander Trocky and the great Terry Southern. You likely recognize Southern's name because of his contributions to Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, but Terry ran with the Wild Boys for many years before and after that. I especially love his collection Red Dirt Marijuana, and also Blue Movie, his raunchy take on the film biz. Alexander Trocky, on the other hand, was some sort of mutant. He could rub elbows with the likes of the very patrician George Plimpton one minute, then immerse himself in the world of junkies and whores the next. Kane's book is as good a place to start as any. Trocky is never an easy read, but that particular book is, if you'll forgive me, the equivalent of a gateway drug. I brought up a couple of golden oldies from my basement. Charles Einstein's The Only Game in Town is a well-researched novel that I think gives a fairly accurate depiction of what life on a minor league ball team in the 1950s was like. It even has a blurb from baseball legend Leo Durocher. There's a funny backstory with this book. My best friend Doug gave it to me as a going-away present when my family moved in the middle of grade 7. I didn't open it for some time, but when I did, found it a riveting read. The only problem was the copy he gave me was missing the last 20 pages. This was, of course, years before the advent of the internet or Amazon, and so for decades I never knew what happened at the climax of the story. Finally, I went online, found a copy, read the ending, and you know, it was excellent, even better than I expected. So Doug, wherever you are, thanks. The other old gem I retrieved is a science fiction romp titled Lucan War. I very much doubt if you're familiar with this one. It's by Michael Collins, the nom de plume of Dennis Linz or Lines, who, as far as I can ascertain, enjoyed some success as a very prolific crime novelist. Collins wrote Lucan War in 1969, likely trying to cash in on the growing interest in the genre, and I have to say, it's not bad. It concerns a first contact between humanity and an intelligent species of plant. Something goes wrong, and a galactic war breaks out. I read it in my teens, still have that copy. Does that make me a collector or a hoarder? A question frequently asked here at Casa Burns. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about one of the curios of my collection, Thomas S. Kleis's The Last Western. When it comes to cult novels, this one meets all the criteria and then some. How's this for a synopsis? Willie is an athletic prodigy, the greatest pitcher ever to emerge from the American Southwest. He's practically unhittable, a star on the diamond. But Willie also has a spiritual calling, so he leaves baseball behind and becomes a priest. Eventually, he assumes the mantle of Pope. He is very progressive, which offends conservatives within the church who plot against him, seeking to bring him down or, if necessary, assassinate him. There's not a wink of satire. It's intended to be a serious work of literature. Definitely marches to its own peculiar drumbeat, and if you ever happen across a copy, it's long out of print, take a chance, and then drop me a line letting me know what you think. A quick mention of William Fairchild's The Poppy Factory. It was retitled No Man's Land for its American release. I won't go into this book in any detail since I wrote about it on Brad Bigelow's Neglected Books site, but Poppy Factory is an excellent World War I novel, set in the trenches, but also the strange region between the lines, where deserters from both sides live underground, emerging at night to terrorize their former comrades. Macabre and very chilling. I want to name drop two Canuck colleagues, Craig Grant and Corey Redicop. Craig authored The Last India Overland back in the 1980s, a book I enthusiastically reviewed at the time. It was a fictionalized account of a bus tour from London to Kathmandu Craig took, experiencing the highs and lows of traveling with a disparate group of people for an extended period of time. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, with a side order of depression, interspersed with moments of terror at various roadblocks and checkpoints manned by gun-toting crazies. Someone should scoop up the rights to The Last India Overland and reprint it. Market it as a Canadian on the road. I think it would find a receptive audience. Corey Redicop only has released two books and some short stories and has yet to make a major breakthrough, but dang, the guy is original and funny, and I predict great things ahead for him. Both his novels, Shelf Monkey and Husk, exhibit humor and intelligence rarely in evidence on the Canadian literary scene. I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to reel off some authors and titles, and again, at some point I will be posting a reading list for each episode covering the books I cite throughout this series. Wrestling Sturbridge by Rich Wallace. Hands down the best young adult novel I've read. Haven't heard of it? No time like the present to search it out and gift it to the 14-year-old in your life. They'll love it. Next is The Intruder, Charles Beaumont's only novel. I was lucky to nab a first edition hardcover when I visited the fabled Change of Hobbit bookstore in Los Angeles back in the mid-80s. The Intruder was adapted into a decent movie, starring William Shatner in his pre-Star Trek days. Gerald Kirsch. Harlan Ellison was a huge fan of Kirsch, who was capable of writing anything from convincing historical fiction to literary dark fantasy. Much of his work is out of print these days, and that's a shame. A Man Jumps Out of an Airplane by Barry Yorgrau. Yorgrau specialized in short tales, surreal episodes and anecdotes praised by the likes of David Byrne and Susan Cheever. Steve Erickson's Days Between Stations. Mysterious, dreamlike. Those who love Paul Auster's early novels will fall for this one. Another author working similar territory is Nicholas Christopher. I especially admire Somewhere in the Night, his nonfiction book on film noir. But Christopher's novels, Veronica and A Trip to the Stars, are entrancing as well. Bruno Schulz. Murdered by the Nazis, yet his wonderful fables and artwork survive, a testament to his genius. His tale, Street of Crocodiles, is an excellent starting point, and don't miss the film version, animated by the brothers Quay. William Goyen. If you dig Cormac McCarthy, Goyen is for you. Was equally proficient at novels and short stories, underappreciated even during his lifetime. The Mystic Arts of Erasing All Signs of Death by Charlie Houston. Ever wondered how cleaners get the blood and body fluids out of carpets and walls at crime scenes? Then this is the novel for you. James Othmer's The Futurist. Satirical, fun read. Jim Dodge. Big in the 1970s, unknown today. Not Fade Away and Stone Junction impressed me way back when, though admittedly, I haven't read Dodge in many years. And finally, a plug for the work of Paul DeFilippo, an author who refuses to acknowledge genre constraints and tropes, and as a result, consistently delivers high-end original science fiction. And that's it. A roster of great and mostly forgotten books and authors that will add a little character to your bookshelves and sharpen your mental processes. Tired of the same old, any one of the aforementioned books will pull you out of your intellectual rut and get those neurons firing. Some of them, admittedly, will be extremely hard to find, even when employing resources like bookfinder.com or similar sites. Don't be discouraged. Stick with it, and I promise the rewards will greatly outweigh the time, money, and effort expended. Good hunting to you. Time to check in with the Midnight Detective. He's been brooding in his corner office for the past while, alternately staring out a small filthy window or regarding the near-empty glass in front of him. He's in a somber mood these days, possibly the result of his long tenure sitting behind that desk day after day, listening to the stories his clients tell, wishing they would get to the point. The door's open. Don't worry, he's expecting you. I'm not much of a reader, but I love old movies, especially black and white pictures, their slanting light and looming shadows. We tend to forget these days with artificial light and neon garishness that for half the world it's night, darkness only 10 or 12 hours away, maybe less depending on where you live or the time of year. There was a little man who came to see me once, dapper, neat, clean fingernails and hopeful smile. He was a librarian, it turned out, and he wanted to hire me to find out whoever it was that was coming in and damaging or tampering with books. I asked him why he didn't just check the security footage, and he appeared genuinely offended. That's only by the front counter, he protested. Because of the neighborhood, we deal with occasional intoxicated individuals or what have you. So no cameras, no way of identifying possible suspects. And you're telling me, what, every so often someone wanders in, picks up a book, rips out some pages. Not rips, he corrected me. Cuts. And not entire pages, just certain passages. He excises them very neatly, and if I may say so, quite professionally. Is there something in common about these books? He shook his head. Books on all subjects, old and new. I will say, he paused, whoever it is seems to have an aversion to graphic violence and excessive use of profanities. A little old church lady, I ventured. He shrugged. There's simply no way of telling. Our staff makes the rounds. There's an elderly commissionaire on duty, but no one has been able to spot the culprit and catch them red-handed. And that's where I come in. It is my view that an expert eye is required to uncover this book butcher. I think I sighed. It had been a slow week and my rent was due. I agreed to swing by, reconnoiter the situation, and we settled on a price. He didn't quibble much, even though he was paying for it out of pocket. Not sure he could square my bill with his board. I got lucky the second day. Ted, the chatty commissionaire who was always seen to be hovering about, waiting for me to make a pinch, called in sick. His replacement, Glenda, was short, stout, and exceedingly lazy. She also appeared to have a bladder problem, frequently disappearing into the bathroom, neglecting her duties for extended periods of time. I don't know what made me look at him that second time. I glanced up from my station near the free computers, saw this old professional type making his way toward the back with two or three fat hardcovers under his arm. He moved stiffly and gripped a wooden cane in his other hand. There was something about him, and when I looked up again, he was disappearing into travel and leisure. I waited 10 minutes and went for a stroll. He never saw me coming. As I watched, he leaned close to the page and used a sharp little tool like an X-Acto knife to carve out two short paragraphs. Something you don't approve of? He gave a little jump, turned to me, not bothering to feign innocence. I don't know why they have to make everything so ugly. I walked over, shifted the book so I could see its cover, some thriller by the latest flavor of the month. It's not enough that they have to have all this killing and bloodshed. They also feel compelled to glamorize it. His hand was shaking, his pallor amplified by the blue sweater and bright scarf he was wearing. I'd seen that shade of yellow on a person before, during my mother's final days, recognized renal failure when I saw it. I'm just so tired of the ugliness and needless brutality. His head down, voice almost inaudible. Do you think it's a case of art imitating life, or vice versa? He raised his shoulders, exhausted, almost emptied out. Does it matter? He had me there. I told the dapper librarian his problem would soon be over, provided nothing more in the way of details. At first, he tried arguing with me about client privilege or some such bullshit, but I shut him down hard. I'm done, I told him. And that was that. Not one of my more celebrated cases, I guess. Crime, but no punishment. Not in the conventional sense, anyways. I only hope he didn't suffer in the end.
I suppose it was his way of trying to make the world a better place before he left it. How many stories would we all like to rewrite? How many words we'd take back if we could? If only there was a way of fixing the narrative so everything turns out all right, instead of just closing the book. Go on, get out. Story time's over. Find your entertainment elsewhere, damn you.
That brings us to the conclusion of another episode of Standing at an Angle to the Universe. I really enjoyed going through my bookshelves, finding my favorite neglected books, and as always, it's my hope that you'll hear about certain titles here and seek them out for yourself. And yes, please drop me a line if you have any thoughts about the books I mentioned on the program, pro or con. Our sponsor this time around is Sheathing Funeral Services of Craig Lang, Ian Duncan Sheathing, owner and proprietor. Dedicated to providing the best client care and afterlife maintenance possible, Sheathing Funeral Services. Come in for a chat, stay for an eternity. And don't forget to ask us about our layaway plan. Thanks for hanging out with me. See you again next time.